2, last May in audio letter 24, I quoted at length from the warnings of General George Keegan, who retired at the beginning of this year as the Chief of Air Force Intelligence. General Keegan is as great a patriot as he is an intelligence analyst, and it was he who first warned America that Russia was developing the awesome particle beam weapon. Earlier this month, on December 14, General Keegan was interviewed on the Bob Snyder radio show, stationed WDCL in Clearwater, Florida. General Keegan described the bleak military picture we now confront in graphic terms. As his final question to General Keegan, Bob Snyder asked General Keegan, quote, "You already said that the Russians could possibly capture Europe in 36 hours. If war broke out between the United States and Russia, I said if, who would win?" General Keegan's answer was, and I quote, "There is no question in my mind that the Soviet Union would win," unquote. For more information about General Keegan's comments, I strongly suggest that you write to Mr. Snyder directly. He publishes a very timely and informative newsletter, and you can write to him at the Bob Snyder Newsletter, Box 15, Safety Harbor, Florida, ZIP 33572. For those who are willing to open their eyes and see, more and more bits of the truth are surfacing here and there that point to our true situation. But so far, only one major newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, has seen fit to do an in-depth job of alerting its readers to the possible magnitude of the silent war that is already going on. When I revealed the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976 during July and August of that year, I alerted you to the major emphasis that the Soviet Union now puts on its Navy. And in a Sunday edition earlier this month, the Chicago Tribune ran a series of articles in a special report section entitled Undersea Warfare. Originally, the articles were to have run over a period of days beginning on December 7, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. But rather than run the risk of being pressured to halt the series after it began, the Tribune had the courage to run them all at once on Sunday, December 4, 1977. I strongly recommend that you go to your library and read the Chicago Tribune articles on undersea warfare in their entirety, and read them closely, my friends. To give you some idea of what you'll find, I'll now quote some passages from the various articles, including both the special report section and the lead article, which appeared on page 1. Quote, "The cold, dark war underseas is an expensive and essential element of Allied military planning at all levels. Occasionally, its muffled sounds reach the ears of the public, but not often. The underseas war is rigged for silent running," unquote. And quote, "The reason the ASW, anti-submarine warfare programs, are cloaked in so much secrecy," officials said, "is that defending the sea has become the weakest link in the chain of American preparation for both conventional and nuclear war," unquote. Two paragraphs later, quote, "The high stakes involved have also produced a continuing mini-war on and below the high seas as ships, submarines, and planes of the United States and its allies fence with Soviet forces testing each other's systems. One arena for these so far bloodless encounters is the North Atlantic, where the United States has positioned its most effective ASW forces and equipment," unquote. Later in the same article, quote, "But it was learned that the system is far from completely effective. Frequently, United States hunters lose Soviet submarines after tracking them for a while. As a result, the United States command is confident it knows how many Soviet submarines are at sea, but little confidence about their whereabouts, unquote. I might mention, my friends, that 2.5 years ago, in May 1975, Admiral Gorshkov, the head of the Soviet Navy, declared that the Soviet Union has solved the problem of tracking and neutralizing our submarines. In September 1976, I revealed that a Soviet missile-planting mini-submarine had become trapped in Chesapeake Bay due to a mechanical malfunction. I urged that it be captured by the United States Navy, and the incident used to expose to the whole world the Soviet preparations for surprise nuclear attack. But as I reported the following month in Audio Letter 17, President Gerald Ford knuckled under to Soviet demands in the Red Friday Agreement of October 1, 1976, and the Soviet Navy was allowed to enter Chesapeake Bay under cover of night to retrieve the mini-sub, whose crew had died by then. The very idea that a Soviet submarine could penetrate so deeply into American territorial waters struck some of my listeners as incredible at the time. And the idea that we would let them get away with it may have seemed even more far-fetched to those who do not understand what is really going on behind the scenes. But listen now to quotations from the Chicago Tribune page 1 lead story about undersea warfare by Jim Coates and Jack Fuller. The headline is United States-Soviet Subs Prowling Dangerous Waters. Quote, United States spy submarines have been penetrating Soviet territorial waters for the last 30 months despite a widespread belief inside the government that the controversial maneuvers had stopped, sources have told the Tribune, unquote. Two paragraphs later, after citing Holy Stone as the code name for the program, quote, on one occasion before the 1975 disclosures, the Tribune learned a United States spy submarine was temporarily grounded beneath the busy port of Vladivostok. Holy Stone critics attempted to demonstrate the seriousness of the penetrations by speculating what American reaction would be if a Soviet submarine were discovered aground in San Diego Harbor. While few details were available about the Vladivostok incident, sources said it apparently occurred when the vessel was running on low power to avoid detection and struck the harbor bottom, unquote. Further on, quote, intelligence insiders said that the Russians have known about the United States missions for years, even when they were carried out under tight security. Because the Soviets have never publicly complained about the U.S. undersea forays, some analysts have suggested that a similar Russian probing of American sea space is underway, unquote. And one more quotation. Several former government officials agreed to shed light on the silent battles under the seas. Some said they were willing to speak in an effort to illustrate the dangers of the current situation, unquote. My friends, the undersea bombs and missiles I've told you about now for well over a year multiply these dangers many times over. So do their close relatives, the underwater mines that are now planted all around the United States as well as in other countries. But what makes them most deadly is the failure to take counteractive measures. It's now been proven that undersea missiles and bombs, as well as underwater nuclear mines planted near our dams, can be located and removed, given the proper equipment and the will to use it. Last month, I warned that the Kensico Reservoir, Tarrytown Reservoir, and Pocantico Lake north of New York City all contain Soviet nuclear mines, as did the Hudson River near the east end of the Tappan Zee Bridge. On December 7, I received an important call from an official of Westchester County. It was only the first call, but for once, someone was taking the threat seriously. Within days, action was quietly being taken to find and remove the bombs in the three bodies of water, and by late last week, I received word that all three had been successfully located and removed. Meanwhile, the so-called federal dam inspection program has suddenly shifted into high gear, providing a perfect opportunity for the Army Corps of Engineers to find and remove many more nuclear mines nationwide. So far, I can only confirm that Westchester County, the home of the Rockefellers, has benefited from such quick action. As for the undersea cobalt bombs that now dot the ocean floor worldwide, the Union of South Africa has become the first nation to take action. In late September, I informed the government through intermediaries of the locations of 10 Soviet cobalt bombs planted off the South African coast. They were planted along the coast from a point about 200 miles northwest of Cape Town, around the Cape of Good Hope, and around to the east to a point about 160 miles east, northeast of Durban. I also relayed the locations of two bombs within South Africa, one near Johannesburg, the other close to Kimberley. The South African government is taking measures to remove these bombs, and so far, four bombs from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth have been found and removed. That's the good news, my friends. But the bad news is that nowhere is the public being let in on what is happening. As a result, it's only a matter of time until Soviet agents secretly replace the bombs that have been secretly removed from the two reservoirs and the lake in Westchester County, just as the Soviet Navy has always replaced undersea missiles wherever they were picked up. By the same token, bombs secretly removed by South Africa will eventually be replaced. The end of all this secret jockeying is demonstrated by the current plight of the United States, and now Great Britain as well. Over a year ago, the United States Navy was forced to cease and desist from removing each round of Soviet undersea missiles from our territorial waters as they were planted. Now over 200 short-range Soviet nuclear missiles infest our territorial waters, including over 50 in the Great Lakes. Great Britain held out for a full year longer than the United States, but she too has finally succumbed. For a year and more, the Royal Navy kept locating and extracting Soviet undersea missiles from her own waters. But this fact, unfortunately, was never made public officially. America's disastrous loss of the space battle of the Harvest Moon in late September rendered the situation untenable. And in early October, British Foreign Minister David Owen went to Moscow to capitulate. And now, as a result, the British Isles are surrounded by no fewer than 60 Soviet underwater missiles, 52 around England, Wales, and Scotland, and 8 around Ireland. As in August 1976, Great Britain is once again more densely targeted by Soviet undersea missiles than any other spot on Earth. And Britain, the only other power to join the United States and the Soviet Union in the so-called SALT talks, is now joining the United States in the process of surrender through disarmament. The badly weakened NATO alliance is now in the process of being neutralized and dismantled completely. For years, the growing might of the Warsaw Pact nations has been tipping the military balance in Europe ever more heavily against NATO. But the process that is now splitting and destroying NATO is not the Warsaw Pact threat. The coup de grace is being delivered by the controlled Carter administration, obediently doing as it is told by the Soviet Union. The Carter administration is abandoning NATO, and the Europeans know it. Very much the same process had been planned anyway under the Rockefeller Grand Design that I've detailed for you in the past. But now, since the Rockefeller plans unraveled in late September, the Soviet Union is in control. And like a judo throw that enables a person to use his opponent's strength to defeat him, the Soviet Union is now using the Rockefeller brothers' own machinations against them. NATO badly needs the ground launch cruise missile in order to offset the sheer numerical superiority of Warsaw Pact forces. Originally, the cruise missile was intended to be what is called a theater weapon, whether used in the air, on the ground, or at sea. For that purpose, the cruise missile would be very useful. But in order to provide an excuse for the scrapping of the B-1 bomber, a true strategic weapon system, the image of the cruise missile was upgraded to that of a fearsome new strategic weapon, which it is not. And now, the range of the cruise missile is being restricted in the SALT talks so as to cripple its effectiveness. Our NATO allies are watching helplessly as the Carter administration bargains away their dwindling hopes for continued survival. The same is true of the neutron bomb, which has been given an image that makes it very hard for European politicians to defend to its public. Yet NATO military planners see it as the only effective way to erase the ability of the Warsaw Pact to roll over their countries and conquer them in a blitzkrieg. The massive armored might of the Warsaw Pact forces would be neutralized by the neutron bomb because the radiation it produces would penetrate the armor plate and incapacitate or kill the crews inside. And they would not lay waste their own country in the process of defending them if the neutron bombs were used. But Radio Moscow hammers away every day against the neutron bomb, and the Carter administration is now throwing away the right to give NATO the neutron bomb in the SALT talks. Meanwhile, the security of Western Europe grows more precarious by the day. Certain forces within the CIA have already lit the fuse that is intended to make the Middle East explode into war by programming President Sadat of Egypt to seek a separate peace with Israel. At the same time, reports have reached the West of a rare conference in Moscow of the Soviet Union's top military leaders in Europe, the Far East, and around the Soviet frontiers. The entire purpose of the conference was to alert all Soviet forces to be on continuous alert to go to war at a moment's notice. Events are moving steadily forward to the stage of the horrendous act of terrorism which I warned last March, which will throw all three major religions into turmoil while triggering a war. Consider these words of Israeli Prime Minister Begin on Sunday, December 18, just a few days ago. Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation, Begin said, and I quote, "If we reach an agreement, as I hope we shall, then I would suggest that President Carter invites both President Sadat and myself to come to Washington. And then we shall be, let me say, a cycle of friendship and faith. A Christian president, a Muslim leader, and the Jewish prime minister, and announce to the world, peace unto you." Unquote. When war comes in the Middle East, the Soviet Union now plans to pick up all the pieces, yet leave the United States to receive the blame of world opinion for helping bring about the war. The Carter administration is not master of its own house and has now been drawn into the position of being a party to the separate peace negotiations that are leading to war. Radio Moscow, meanwhile, is speaking out continually against the treachery that has divided the Arab world as never before. When the Middle East war comes, it will cripple the heart of Europe, which depends on the Middle East for most of its oil. It will be the final straw for Western Europe, which will fall into Russia's hands like a ripe plum, either by military invasion or by going the way of Finland and tacitly joining the Soviet sphere of influence. Southern Africa will be dealt a mortal blow as well, cut off from European supplies and support, and 90% of its oil from Iran. And the Middle East itself, thanks to the unceasing Soviet denunciations of what is happening now, will slip back under more complete Soviet domination than ever before. It will be another Vietnam for the United States, only far worse. NATO will be no more, and after expending American lives and losing billions in military hardware, America's only reward will be the fruits of a cutoff of oil from the Middle East. Manipulation of the resulting shortages will make them seem far worse than they really are, and emergency economic controls will be imposed by our outlaw government to grind us all down under ever more complete control. My friends, the situation is grave. The only significant reservoir of patriotism and loyalty to America that still exists at the top levels of our government is in the ranks of the military. In the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976, it was the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not Congress and not the President, who were responsible for preventing a nuclear Pearl Harbor attack on America. General George S. Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, took action only within the constraints of law, but it was he who argued mightily and successfully for President Ford to overrule Henry Kissinger and give the order for the Soviet missiles to be removed. The Kremlin can smell the scent of victory and does not intend to be tripped up again. So the Carter administration has been ordered by Russia to dismantle the Joint Chiefs of Staff by making drastic changes that will destroy its effectiveness. Preparations to do this are now underway, and already articles critical of the Joint Chiefs are appearing in order to prepare the public to accept any such change without giving it a second thought. If anything at all is to be done to arrest the headlong tumble of our country into disaster, it will have to include superb strategy and expert coordination of our weakened military forces. Once the Joint Chiefs of Staff structure is gone, that chance will be gone with it. But unless the wait-and-see attitude of many Americans changes very quickly, the Joint Chiefs of Staff are finished. Topic number 3. My friends, recently I have challenged the four Rockefeller brothers, now that their grand plan has been upset by the Soviet Union, to turn over a new leaf. I have urged them to cast their lot with us, the people of the United States of America, and to begin using their wealth and resources for the good of us all. Even at this late date, a sincere new beginning might enable their names to go down in history with honor instead of with a curse. But I must tell you now, my friends, that we have their answer. I've told you in the past about the role of the Rockefeller Empire in helping to finance the Bolshevik Revolution to take over Russia in 1917. And I've told you about the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance that grew out of that. And since the spring of 1976, I've been chronicling for you the collapse of this alliance in mutual double-cross. What an earlier Rockefeller generation spawned has gotten out of control of the third generation. But having learned nothing from this, the four Rockefeller brothers are now preparing to attempt a repeat performance, that is, a new Bolshevik revolution right here in the United States of America. Last month, I let you in on the secret of understanding the Kremlin today. The Kremlin is now run not by the atheistic communists known as Bolsheviks, but self-proclaimed spiritual communists. Unlike the old Bolsheviks, who were always internationally minded and cooperated with the Rockefeller Empire, the spiritual communists are strong nationalists who want Soviet Russia to rule the world. As the alliance between the Rockefellers and the Soviets has been disintegrating, so too has the internal alliance between the old Bolsheviks and spiritual communists in Russia. More and more of the old Bolsheviks are being expelled from Russia, only to be welcomed into the United States with open arms. And the key federal regulatory agencies, which govern Americans' lives and commerce, are rapidly being packed with hundreds and hundreds of these arrivals from the Soviet Union. Just as outsiders sealed Russia's fate in 1917, the stage is being set here and now in the United States for a new Bolshevik revolution. The old Bolsheviks flooding into our country from the Soviet Union are bitter enemies of the current regime in Russia. The positions of power and control which they once enjoyed there have been lost. The Rockefeller brothers, too, are now the Kremlin's bitter enemies. So the alliance between them is a natural one, continuing, in fact, an alliance that used to link Washington and Moscow. The Rockefellers believe that the flood of Bolsheviks into our government is the fastest way they have of rooting out the large number of Soviet agents whom they placed in our government in the first place and who still take their orders from Moscow. But, my friends, this unholy alliance within our own land, while it is directed against Russia, is also directed against you and me. The freedom we love, our Constitution, our entire way of life, is to be destroyed and replaced by the Bolshevik system of total control over our lives. My friends, this is hardly the kind of message that I enjoy recording just 3 days before celebrating the birth of our Lord Jesus the Christ. But it is He who said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And my Christmas wish for you and your loved ones is freedom, now and in the future. Without truth, freedom is impossible. But it is easy to be free once you know the truth. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.